The word lifestyle has moved around in our culture since it first appeared more than 35 years ago. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg says the word has evolved from a way to describe the 60s counterculture to a marketing tool and a political catchphrase.
Some words are born stars, but others have to wait patiently in the wings for years until the world suddenly realizes it has a need for them. The word lifestyle entered the language early in the 20th century, but for the first 50 years of its existence, it was an obscure bit of sociological and psychoanalytic jargon. In the whole of 1967, the word appeared in the Chicago Tribune exactly 7 times. But 5 years later, that figure had jumped to 3,300, and the word was on everybody's lips. A newspaper cartoon showed a little boy coming home from school and telling his mom, "Today we learned about the unalienable rights, lifestyle, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." A lot of the credit for that surge belongs to a 1970 book by a Yale professor named Charles Reich. The Greening of America was an exuberant paean to the youth culture with its beads, bell bottoms, drugs, and casual sex. The new lifestyle, Reich said, presaged nothing less than the advent of a new form of human consciousness, which would prove to be far more world-shaking than merely political upheavals like the Russian or French revolutions. In retrospect, as the Weekly Standard's David Skinner pointed out recently, Reich did little more than raise the modish radical clichés of the time to the status of profundities. The critics were scathing. Liberals panned the book because it suggested that drugs and sex were an alternative to political activism. Conservatives panned it because it countenanced drugs and sex at all. Just last year, in fact, the conservative weekly Human Events included The Greening of America on its list of the most harmful books of the last 2 centuries, in a dead heat with Frantz Fanon's The Wretched of the Earth. But Reich's book was a huge popular success, and it took the word lifestyle along with it. There may have been nothing new about the idea that different groups had their own characteristic fashions, morals, and mores, but the second those patterns started going by the name of lifestyles, everybody suddenly had to have one. Lifestyle was clearly a word whose time had come. That was the moment when marketing analysts were replacing social scientists as the new cartographers of the American social landscape. People took to dropping words like demographics and upscale into their conversations. The old vocabulary of social class was being replaced by new consumer classifications like empty nesters, Gen X, trendies, and yuppies. And the entry requirements for becoming a preppy were relaxed from 4 years at Andover or Choate to an afternoon at Abercrombie and Fitch. It wasn't exactly the revolution of consciousness that Reich had had in mind. But the notion of lifestyles flattered people that their consumer choices could be the fundamental fabric of their social identity, at least for people who had the resources to make them. Not everybody gets to have a lifestyle, after all. You don't see many references to the lifestyles of undocumented immigrants or hourly workers. It's all they can do just to have a life. But for everybody else, lifestyle became the new organizing principle of consumer culture. The old fashion, shopping, and society pages were merged in the Sunday lifestyle section that paraded the richly varied forms of having that America offers. And then there's the vast uber-lifestyle divide between red and blue America, which was first unearthed around the time that Reich's book appeared. In 1970, Time magazine named as its Man and Woman of the Year the newly discovered middle Americans, whom it defined by their consumption and leisure habits. Middle Americans, Time explained, just a little condescendingly, were people who learned baton twirling rather than read Hermann Hesse, who skipped Midnight Cowboy in favor of John Wayne and the Green Berets, and who preferred the Rockettes at Radio City Music Hall to O Calcutta. There's a direct line from those descriptions down to the modern picture of an America riven into 2 nations that are barely capable of speaking to each other, the one listening to Lynyrd Skynyrd in their Chevy Avalanches, the other listening to Radiohead in their Priuses. Contemplating that chasm, commentators have announced with a straight face that the country is more divided than at any time since the Civil War. You've got 80 to 90% of the country that look at each other as if they were on separate planets, as one analyst says. It's a view everybody seems to accept, even if all the data actually show that the country's more uniform in both its culture and political attitudes than at any time in recent history. But the fascination with lifestyles always leads to exaggerating the significance of shallow differences, which is why the word can be useful to people who want to deny the existence of the deep ones. You can hear that in the way social conservatives denounce the gay lifestyle or the homosexual lifestyle. Gay and lesbian civil rights groups often object to those phrases as implying that there's only a single gay lifestyle, the familiar stereotype of poodles, poppers, and promiscuity. But the real affront is simply in using the word lifestyle in the first place, as if homosexuality were just another choice like deciding to get a mullet or build a backyard hot tub. That's the dark side of the obsession with lifestyles. It suggests that people choose to be everything they are. If you're different from me, you've got nobody but yourself to blame.
Jeff Nunberg is the author of a new book on language and politics called Talking Right.